Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Last week we heard how Potomac Airfield had been overrun by the Russians on the 16th of January 1943, and they're now closing in on the 6th Army, trapped inside the Kessel and the small pocket in Stalingrad. These are the last days of the men trapped inside the frozen city, starving and out of ammunition. General Paulus had finally realized the futility of trusting Goering and Hitler, far too late for his men. While the initial figure trapped had been close to 250,000, many had died or been taken prisoner, and had got away. By the 25th of January, there were more like 100,000 men inside the final tomb of the 6th Army. The wounded alone numbered more than 20,000, and most were not being treated at all. They lay in the cold until hypothermia killed them. If there ever was an advertisement for ending war, the last days of Stalingrad would be the opening and closing scenes. Some of the stories I'm going to relate are beyond comprehension, beyond anything dreamed up by the most creative sadists or the most bloody-minded novelists. There is something of the inhuman, the monster, about this saga. After Potomac Airfield had been abandoned by the Germans, great suffering took place. The wounded had been concentrated there, awaiting airlifts, but those who could not walk or missed the last truck out of the airfield were going to be pounced upon by the Red Army. A single doctor and medical orderly joined them. Most of these would be killed by the Russians out of hand, an eye for an eye. The rest limped or crawled away. Others were placed in large sledges and dragged behind the few trucks that had a few liters of fuel. All were on their way to Gumrak Airfield, which was a scant 8 miles east through the ice and snow. When the clouds cleared at times, it blinded the men, and at night the shadows turned steel blue while the sun itself set in an abnormal orange glow. It was as though they had already arrived at Hades with the conditions of a nightmare prevailing. And the condition of all the men, not just the wounded, was pitiful in the extreme. Their hands, feet and faces were frostbitten, lips cracked open, faces pale and waxy and corpse-like. Hundreds slumped in the snow, never to rise again. As they died, others would strip them, as frozen corpses were impossible to undress. And of course, stalking these dying figures were the Russians. A Soviet journalist by the name of Grossman, who I've mentioned before, was in the vanguard of the units approaching Potomac. "There are frozen Germans, their bodies undamaged along the road we follow," he wrote. "It wasn't us who killed them, it was the cold. They have bad boots and bad coats. Their tunics are thin and look like paper." The crows circled, then landed and pecked out the eyes of the corpses as Grossman watched. The Russian infantry approached Potomac following the T-34s, but just before they arrived, Soviet officers were confused by what looked like a village. It was not marked on the map. As they neared the dark patch on the steppe, they saw it was a massive military junkyard, full of shot-up panzers and trucks, gutted wrecked aircraft, cars, assault guns, half-tracks, artillery tractors, and huge piles of equipment of various types. They saw the giant Focke Wulf Condor aircraft burned out, then the smashed wreckage of the Messerschmitts and Heinkels and Junkers. The experienced Russian soldiers had been bombed and strafed by these aircraft for 2 years. Now they marched past relics of the German 6th Army's heyday. German officers began to think about an honorable way out other than fighting to the death or being captured by the terrifying Russians. One doctor recorded how he was approached by several commanders who came to us and begged for poison to commit suicide. But the medical staff were the real heroes at this time. None of the 600 German doctors at Stalingrad tried to fly out, unless they were one of the wounded or the sick. They remained with their patients right to the end. Most would die, either in the revenge shootings or while in prison of war camps. They were faced with conditions unheard of, even in history books. Patients shared beds while severely wounded were no longer being treated, merely waved away. There were too many hopeless cases. There was no plaster of Paris, so shattered limbs were bound with paper. Post-operative shock killed many more. Diphtheria increased exponentially now. All wounded suffered from legions of lice. One doctor wrote, "On the operating table, we had to scrape lice off uniforms and skin with a spatula and throw them into the fire. We also had to remove them from eyebrows and beards where they were clustered like grapes." Potomnik had been a disaster. Now Gumrak was a catastrophe. The Catholic chaplain of Gumrak Hospital became known as the Death King of Gumrak because he was conducting final rites on 200 men a day. After death, the bottom half of their identity disc was snapped off as proof the soldier had died, and the chaplains would keep these in their pockets. By the end of the day, the pockets were bulging and clanking like malevolent moneylenders. Potomnik was lost on the 16th of January 1943. By the 17th, the fighting had died down, and most Germans were now squeezed in the eastern half of the Kessel. Russian General Rokossovsky was gearing up for a final push into the city, and he had decided to redeploy some of his men. General Paulus, meanwhile, was convinced that the end was near and sent a signal on the 16th to General Zeitzler back at OKH headquarters in Rustenburg, commending that the units should be able to move or break out southwards. Paulus said that remaining in the Kessel meant either imprisonment or death anyway, and he implied that his men should be allowed to go down fighting. Individual actions were still surprising on both sides, either heroic or cowardly. For example, some German units continued to fight a dogged resistance in an echo of how the Russians had fought doggedly in various towns and cities, trying to slow the Reich's jackboot flood over their countryside. German General Janik, for example, reported that an officer had managed to hold off an attack by T-34s near Basagino station, and claimed that the officer had operated an anti-aircraft gun single-handedly, destroying 15 tanks. This may or may not be true, but it is clear that the kinds of anarchic solo struggles became the feature of the battle. Most Germans were moving slowly in a kind of drug-induced lethargy, like zombies. It was starvation and apathy driving them to their graves. While the Germans were fighting in the front lines, there was some sense of discipline there, driven largely by the need to survive. But in the rear, discipline had broken down. On the evening of the 17th of January, a staff officer with the 371st Infantry Division told Lieutenant Colonel Marder a code word LION meant the whole Kessel would then fight its way out on all sides. That was Paulus's order, and he was awaiting the final command from the Führer, giving him permission to allow his men some semblance of honour. Regimental commanders were to assemble fighting groups of around 200 of their best men, inform the rest of the line that they were to march behind, then break out when the command LION was issued. Other officers discussed ways to try to escape capture, helped by the Hiwi Russians who'd thrown in their lot with the Germans at the start of the campaign. These men were now in danger of being executed en masse and were looking for ways out. Their German comrades could use Red Army uniforms and work with the Russian speakers to slip through enemy lines. Sounds like a good idea instead of lying down and being run over. One of these was an officer known as Freytag Rohrenhoven of the 16th Panzer Division. He had seen the worst of the fighting for 6 months and had every right to try to find a way out. Other officers of the 16th Panzer thought it may work, including its commander, General Angern. The corps commander, General Strecker, came to hear about the plan and was briefly tempted to join, but believed strongly in traditional military values. He did not want to leave his men, so stayed behind. But he honored the officers' wish to fight on and allowed them to leave. One group from the 11th Corps made an attempt at the same time as other small detachments of Hueys and officers who made a run for freedom. Some did make it out. But two staff officers from the 6th Army HQ, Colonel Echlep and Lieutenant Colonel Niemeyer, who was the chief of intelligence, died trying. Ironically, Freytag Rohrenhoven did not have to make a run for it. He was going to be flown to safety anyway. Time was running out. Paulus decided to step up evacuation of some specialists in the 6th Army so that they could rebuild the army from scratch back home, or at least that was the motivation. So Paulus ordered his commanders to pick out the specialists who'd been given a ticket to freedom. As these men made their way to the front of the queue of wounded waiting at Gumrak on January 18th, they were glared at in open hostility. The list of those who departed is interesting. One was General Erwin Janicke, commander of the 4th Corps, who I just mentioned. He had 16 shrapnel holes in his body, so leaving was mainly for treatment. Captain Eberhard Wachmann flew out clutching the Chief of Staff Schmidt's last will and testament. Each division selected officers and NCOs to form a cadre of the new 6th Army that would fight again someday, somewhere, At least, that was the plan. Major Kulistin von Zitzewitz was probably the most interesting of the lot. You see, he carried a box with General Paulus's medals, his wedding ring and signet ring, which was destined for Paulus's wife. They wouldn't remain at General Paulus's home for long, however. The Gestapo arrived and seized him after the surrender, which we'll hear about in two episodes. General Hans Huber received orders to leave early on the 19th of January on the way to join General Milch's special staff, who were going to set up his new army. So Huber drew up his own list of what he called trusted and energetic officers. Instead of trying to save men who were experts in the concept of air supply, which is what the Germans needed most, Huber instead selected his old comrades of the Panzer Corps to join him in safety. Dear listener, we must cast our gaze back on Germany, where probably the most famous speech delivered by propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels had just been delivered at the Sportspalast. It's become known as the Total War Speech, and the Nazis screened the audience very carefully for the 18th of February 1943 recording. This took place against the background of the tide of World War II turning against Nazi Germany and its Axis allies. Goebbels warned that if the Wehrmacht could not win on the Eastern Front, the German Reich would fall to Bolshevism and the rest of Europe shortly afterwards. He also stressed that the German army was the only that had the strength to oppose communism and that extreme danger was at hand and Germany had to act quickly. It was time for radical measures, said Goebbels. I ask you, do you want total war? If necessary, do you want a war more total and radical than anything that we can even yet imagine? He asked. Of course, the gas chambers must have been on his mind as he asked this question. But politically, Goebbels was trying to force Hitler to give him greater powers in running the war economy. Hitler was not yet ready to bring the German economy to a total war footing over the objections of his ministers and despite the obvious need. Then socially, many Germans began a whispering campaign after this speech, with its sense of doom growing. The speech led to the spread of a late war whisper joke, popular in Western Germany, especially the Ruhr region, which had been bombed constantly from 1942, and apologies to proper German speakers everywhere for my miserable accent and pronunciation. But it went something like this. Liebe Tony, fliege weiter, wir sind alle Bergarbeiter. Fliege weiter nach Berlin, dar haben sie alle ja geschrien. Which meant, dear Tommy, fly further, we all mine workers here. Fly further to Berlin, there. They've all screamed, yes. On the 20th of January, a day after Goebbels' belligerent speech, Rokossovsky's redeployed Red Army launched another major offensive, which was a renewed attempt at overcoming the extremely weak Germans. The Russian 65th Army broke through the northwest of Gonchara, and their next target was Gumrak, only a few miles away. So Gonchara fell by the night of the 20th. Now the Katyusha rockets lined up and began firing on Gumrak itself, where Paulus remained. By the 22nd of January, conditions were as bad as they had been at Potomac only a few days before. 6th Army Headquarters sent an urgent signal to Manstein, saying, Gumrak airfield unusable from 22nd January at 0400 hours. All was not completely lost, however, as they had converted another landing strip at Stalingradsky for use. The problem was no large plane like a Junkers or Heinkel could land or take off there. Field Marshal Milch, who was with Manstein, interviewed a Luftwaffe major who just returned from the Kessel, and he reported Paulus appeared to have given up. Paulus had apparently said, Whatever help arrives from now on will be too late. We have had it. Our men have no strength left. Gumrak was evacuated, but a lack of fuel meant the 500 wounded were left behind, as had been the case at Potomac. The men who were not comatose were in terror. Reports of what the Russians had done at Potomac circulated. There, the tanks had fired into the gullies of German wounded, killing hundreds, while infantry machine-gunned many more. It was revenge in its purest form. By now, General Paulus and the other commanders had been swiftly moved to Stalingrad, where he'd finally end up in a cellar. More about that in a moment. But first, the allegations and counter-allegations about what happened to the 500 wounded at Gumrak. The Germans claimed after the war they had all been shot and tanks had killed them where they lay. The truth, which emerged later, was that the Russians, like the Germans, made virtually no arrangements for enemy wounded when overrunning defences. When the Red Army took Gumrak, They merely left these wounded men to fend for themselves, to melt snow for water, and to chop up a few remaining horse carcasses for food. It was a full 10 days later that those who were still living were moved to Bekitovka camp. I suppose the reality is whether the wounded were shot immediately or left to freeze and starve to death is nitpicking. Either was a death sentence, as only a handful survived. Once again, the vicious nature of this battle has overcome all sense of humanity. To the south, the Russians had been busy, but German battle groups were fighting a dogged retreat. Early in the morning of the 22nd of January, the remnants of the 297th Infantry Division were pushed back from the Voroponovo sector towards the outskirts of Stalingrad in the south. This is where one of the most extraordinary mini-battles took place of the entire campaign, at least from a German point of view. Major Bruno Gebele and his battalion as part of the 297th lay in wait. They had a single artillery sergeant in command of several mountain howitzers, but very little ammunition. Major Gebele gave him instructions to hold his fire until the Russians were around 200 to 250 yards away. They were obviously about to attack because the Soviet artillery had been peppering Gebele's unit for about an hour as the Germans huddled in their bunkers. At 7 o'clock in the morning, the Russians attacked while the artillery continued the barrage, catching the 297th Battalion off guard. "Herr Major, Sie kommen!" shouted a sentry. Gebele shouted, "Raus!" and his soldiers jumped up into their firing positions. Snow-suited Russian infantry were charging towards them, shouting, "Hurrah! Hurrah! Hurrah!" and were now only 40 yards away. The German grenadiers opened fire with machine guns, rifles, and machine pistols. The Russians suffered terrible losses. Gebele said later, "The first wave killed or left lying there, the second also, and then a third wave came. In front of our position, the Soviet dead piled up and served as a sort of sandbag for us." Still, the Russians continued their attack, but switched direction to target the flanking detachments. At 9:30, they managed to break through eventually by focusing on the Romanian troops on the left flank. Most of Gebele's officers near him had been killed by an anti-tank round, while a bullet from a Russian machine gun killed his chief clerk, the bullet passing straight through his steel helmet. Still more waves of Russians attacked, and Gebele had been wounded in the shoulder but was still firing a carbine with his one good arm. The artillery sergeant opened up with his mortars but only managed to land the bombs on the German positions. It was chaos and carnage. Incredibly, Gebele and the handful left alive held out for 7 hours. It was close to nightfall when he saw a Russian flag flapping on a water tower to his rear. The battalion had been outflanked. It was time to leave, and a few men led by Gebele managed to make their way towards the center of Stalingrad. Inside the city, it was a scene of destruction, apocalyptic. Field Marshal Manstein at Army Group Don headquarters received a coded radio message from Paulus on that evening of the 22nd. "For submittal to the Führer and to Commander-in-Chief Army Group Don, the Russians are advancing on a 6-kilometer frontage, both sides of Voporonovo, towards the east, in part with flying colors." This meant they were striking towards Stalingrad. "There is no possibility to close the gap. All provisions are used up. Over 12,000 unattended wounded men in the pocket. What orders am I to issue to the troops who have no ammunition left?" Paulus had nothing left. "Immediate decision is required, since symptoms of disintegration are noted in some places. However, the troops still have faith in their commanders." Well, that was not true. In the rear, behind the frontline fighting, discipline had evaporated. Hitler's reply was relayed to Paulus by Army Group Don. "Capitulation impossible." Hitler had used italics just in case Paulus was wondering. "The troops will defend their position to the last. The 6th Army has thus made a historic contribution in the most gigantic war effort in German history. Adolf Hitler." Paulus blocked out the bloody mess of men and lives and left Gumrak for his cellar in Stalingrad. Here, descriptions of the contradictions that abound in this battle have been published by writers like Anthony Beaver. For example, members of the 297th who travelled with Gebele included a youngster suffering from frostbite. Two Stalingrad women took pity on him and rubbed his frozen legs for an hour to prevent the frostbite from worsening. "Again and again they looked at me with compassion and said, 'So young, and yet he must already be dying,'" he said later. The same group of soldiers were astonished to find several Russian women in a wrecked house who had just baked a loaf of bread. They exchanged some of the bread for a hunk of horse meat the Germans had carried with them. The retreat from the steppe had brought the number of Germans crowded into the ruined city to 100,000 men. The rest had either splintered out of the closing Russian forces, or been taken prisoner, or were dead or wounded. Most were now suffering from dysentery, jaundice, and diphtheria, their faces a strange green tinge. Regiments were meaningless. The 14th Panzer Division had 80 men left. There were only a handful of heavy weapons and virtually no ammunition. The main driving force to fight was the fear of Russian revenge. It was no longer Hail Hitler. Soviet T-34s crushed Germans and their defences, while bunkers were destroyed by the Red Army using field guns wheeled right up to point-blank range. On the 25th of January, Paulus and one of his senior officers, Colonel Wilhelm Adam, received head wounds from a bomb explosion. Fortunately for them, these were very slight shrapnel wounds, and yet highly symbolic. The Battle of Stalingrad had finally caught up to the general who for so long had made his men pay the price of fascism. So now we halt. There are two episodes left in our story. Next week, more Germans decide to surrender when they hear the Russians have stopped trying to kill all the prisoners. We will also hear how generals caught inside Stalingrad at this point begin to shoot themselves. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you have the inclination, and if you'd like to contact me, do so through the contact form on the homepage of the website, abwarpodcast.com. That's abwarpodcast.com. You can also direct message me on Twitter, at Des Latham. Until then, Dors Fidunia, and tschüss. Bye.